Hi there. Welcome to the Journey On podcast. I'm Dave Smelser. So how's it going for you and yours during our continued shelter at home world? In my world, it's gotten hard to check in with friends or family because how are you reminds so many of my friends that every day is like the one before. So there technically is nothing new to report. It forces more specificity in check-in questions. But on the upside, we did get a backyard badminton set. That's been pretty fun. In any case, know that all of us in the Journey On world are with you and rooting for you. On this week's podcast, we'll think a bit about what this inner stillness we sometimes talk about here looks like when it goes into the outer world, into our relationships. My wife, Grace, and I both got some remarkable training along these lines earlier in life that I'll tell you a bit about. But we'll also think together about how great journeying spirituality masters like Thomas Merton offer us a way forward in conflicts. I'll have a brief clip from a classic movie, and I'll tell plenty of stories. Stories about conflicts are always juicy. Before I launch in, let me mention, as I do each week, that I help lead some pretty delightful, encouraging online groups along these lines that perhaps you'd enjoy checking out. We have one on Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and another on Sunday nights at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You'll have a chance to connect with great, like-minded people from around the country and beyond. For information about how to get connected, email mail, M-A-I-L, at blueoceanfaith.org. All right, kick us off, Ryan Hood, for Resolve Conflicts the Contemplative Way. I've been talking with a friend who's dating a young woman, largely happily, but who's had some very hard-to-get-past conflict with his girlfriend. She will get annoyed by parts of his character, which he agrees are immature. But in bringing them up, she'll get in touch with some latent, deep anger in her, and will lecture him at great high-intensity length that he doesn't know what to do. Or I think of another friend who tells me she was going blindly forward in a long-standing friendship, only to discover that her friend had been secretly stressed out by some aspects of their relationship. My friend still doesn't know what those aspects are. And then suddenly her friend broke the relationship entirely and refused to say why or talk further. And now my friend wonders, what's it going to look like to emotionally let this long-standing friend go without any hope of resolution, much less reconciliation? Or I think of my wife Grace's and my early conflict patterns. She'd be annoyed by what she regarded as small transgressions on my part, small, thoughtless moments for me, that she felt were too trivial to bring up without seeming petty, until I committed one too many of those small transgressions, and then she'd let me have it, upon which I would feel stunned and unsafe, and where she would feel purged of the agitation she'd felt and would be fine, I would need to stick to myself for several days before re-engaging. These sorts of stories make me think of two tracks of conflict resolution. The first comes from a contemplative, spiritual point of view. And the second comes from inherited folk wisdom, and I think they make for a powerful 1-2 punch. Grace and I had an ace in the hole for making our way through hard dynamics like the one I mentioned and others to come, and that we'd both been a part of a Christian group during our college days that emphasized not just spiritual stuff, but also basic teaching on how to grow up, given, I suppose, that the nature of this group was that it was filled with adolescents who had just left home for the first time. So they would teach at some length about things like how to be a friend and have a friend, or relevant to our purposes here, the basic rules of conflict resolution. I also think about this from a contemplative perspective. With some of my spare time during shelter at home, along with reading detective novels and catching Amazon Prime series with Grace that we'd previously missed, and again, enjoying backyard badminton with my kids, I've been reading some Thomas Merton, probably the most famous Christian contemplative in recent times. He is not the easiest read, at least for me, as I often find when I read people who are deeper than I am that they're not the easiest read. But he's got some big ideas that I'm sure we'll explore on Journey On during future episodes the very moment that I understand them. So with Jung, Merton is the great early teacher that meditation and contemplation help us find what he calls our true self. His idea, as far as I understand it, is that we are all irresistibly tempted to strive like crazy, to present ourselves as some fantasy that we wish were true of us, to live in the kind of froth of our emotions and thoughts and frustrations the meditative spirituality is set up to help us get behind. He makes the bold case that God actually doesn't know us in our false selves, that unless we leave those, we risk getting to heaven and having God say to us, "Depart from me, I never knew you," because God can only exist alongside reality, alongside what actually is. And our true self is what we find in what the Bible calls our inner man or woman, this watcher behind the waterfall of our thoughts and emotions that we find in contemplative practice. And Merton says, once we experience this inner man or woman, and discover that God is very much there, yes, we'll find a new kind of peace even in craziness like the coronavirus. But we'll also find that that peace extends beyond us to our immediate relationships and then to all people. This is from Merton's book, New Seeds of Contemplation. The contemplative, he writes, is not isolated in themselves, but is liberated from their egoistic self by humility and purity of heart. Therefore, there is no longer any serious obstacle to simple and humble love of other people. So in the spirit of Merton's insight that our spiritual growth empowers us to be at peace both with our true self and with other people, let me pass on to you both some basic contemplative insights about conflict resolution, and then run through that folk wisdom that has stood Grace and me and some of our friends in such good stead all these years later. Lots of this won't seem like especially exalted wisdom. You'll absolutely have thought of some of this before. But I think if you take it as a package, it's pretty great. Validating Merton's perspective would be something St. Paul says in Romans 12. As far as it depends on you, Paul writes, live at peace with everyone. Now that seems helpful, both as an encouragement that learning the basic rules of conflict resolution is an important part of our growth in life, while also understanding that all we can bring to the table is our own goodwill in this. As far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. So I think of my friend who had the previously good friend who abruptly cut off their friendship. When I think about Paul's wisdom, which also ties into the classic contemplative advice, which is that our daily meditative practice is meant to empower us, to use their metaphor, to get behind the waterfall, as I was alluding to earlier, and as I've talked about many a time on this podcast. Here again is the basic idea. If we think of all of our tumbling and churning emotions and thoughts of our day as a waterfall, they're churning down, then what we do in contemplative practice is we take a breath and we find like an alcove behind the waterfall. So we're not trying to stop the waterfall from coming down. We're not trying to sand off our rough emotions or feel better or solve X, Y, or Z problem or, you know, what anything. We're just observing all those thoughts and emotions during our spiritual practice for a little bit. We're watching them. And Merton is a believer that that watcher self is the true self that he's talking about. That's who we actually are. That's the self that God knows, the one who just watches and observes, not the self that's in the churn, in the tumble, and frantically trying to stuff down hard emotions and solve other problems. Once we've discovered, again, what the Bible calls our inner man or woman, that true self, that watcher behind the waterfall, we're encouraged, as we talked about in a recent journey on, to relax and release. So we have some hard emotion, some hard feeling that we can identify. And we're encouraged, oh, if we're just observing it, we're not trying to stop it. We're not saying it's bad. We're not trying to modify it at all. But we notice it, that we're told, oh, you can like relax your shoulders a little bit in that alcove behind the waterfall and that true self and that watcher. And you can relax your shoulders a bit. You can almost even relax your heart a bit and then just like see it waft away or waft past you if possible. Relax it and release it if it's a problem. What this says to my friend who has lost her previously good friend is that most likely even trying to figure out what went wrong is living in the waterfall, in the froth. That getting behind the waterfall and just noticing whatever she feels when her former friend comes to mind is what it looks like to live with God in her true self. And then, again, she's invited to, if possible, relax and release in that moment. Now, it feels vulnerable to do that. If we could just figure out what went wrong and could correctly assign blame for all the parts of what went wrong, maybe our world would feel safer. But we're told that's actually a fool's game. A good deal of contemplative wisdom about what to do during conflicts is along these lines. Define God with your own watcher, your own inner man or woman, and then to let go without needing to obsessively ruminate and adjudicate right and wrong, but instead to trust God to work out whatever needs working out. That's when things go well and we stay within ourselves, our true selves. So when my friend notices angry or bitter or confused emotions as her former friend comes to mind, living in the froth, the waterfall, means that she'll either try to work out why those hard emotions are justified, or she'll remember that she's a Christian and will try to smooth off those hard emotions because my friend doesn't feel good about that part of herself that, say, hopes for revenge, or that her friend will know what, you know, how much harm she's caused, or that judges the character of her former friend. So my friend will notice all that in the churn and think, I shouldn't be thinking such bitter thoughts. I need to forgive. I need to, you know, do stuff. But she's still in the churn herself. But a powerful aspect of getting behind the waterfall, of going to your inner man or woman and finding God there, particularly in conflicts, is that you don't have to argue with your emotions at all. but just in the spirit of getting into that alcove with God, notice them, even welcome them without having to fix anything. So as I've alluded to on previous podcasts, you can find yourself chuckling as you internally welcome something that seems ugly. You notice, I have feelings of revenge. You say, oh, welcome feelings of revenge. And you just let them sit there. Or you realize, I'm just judging, you know, how mad I am at this former friend who's been so mean. And you just, rather than trying to sand off that you're judging, you just like say, oh, welcome judging my former friend. Then having welcomed those emotions, because you're just watching them from the alcove, you're not trying to modify them. If you can relax and release them, great. But if you can't, you can still just move forward without engaging them, without getting lost in the froth. So having taken this brief contemplative tour, let me mention some of these enduring bits of folk wisdom that Grace and I have learned. So it turns out there's one central formula to keep in mind that's the basis of everything else, and that's this phrase. When you did X, I felt Y. When you did X, I felt Y. So let's think of a small trivial example. So you're roommates with someone and you realize that you've had to do the dishes two or three nights in a row and you thought your deal was that you would alternate, but now it's for the third day and your friend hasn't even commented on it, your roommate, and they're just going on with their day. So you would say to them, oh, I guess when you left me the dishes to do, I felt disregarded or something. The alternative to this is labeling the behavior you don't like. So instead of saying, when you left the dishes for the third day in a row, I felt disregarded, you might get, in your anger, say something like, why are you so inconsiderate? Now, we'll look into that in more depth in just a minute, but maybe you can see why the first is better than the second. So part of the genius of when you did X, I felt Y, is that it's honest. The other person might argue you shouldn't have felt what you felt, but they can't argue that you did feel what you felt. All you're doing is letting them know in the thought that they'd want to know. So sticking to this rule struck me as central to my friend I mentioned earlier, who's kind of growing up in certain ways, and his girlfriend points out all his immaturities but gets really mad, and so we'll lecture him for a bit. This rule strikes me as central to their way forward, that for her, labeling all his bad behaviors at length is not going to move them forward. If there's bad behaviors, noting them as they come up, when you did X, I felt Y, strikes me as the way he can grow and the way the relationship can grow. But the current system is probably not doomed to success or not likely to be successful. So the key phrase, when you did X, I felt Y. So here's the next bit of folk wisdom. Keep short accounts. Keep short accounts. I actually think of this with, this is my little brief movie clip moment. I was thinking, oh yeah, when back in the day, I was a playwright for a few years. And the model for my playwriting, because I'm an old man, was this great popular comic writer, Neil Simon. Neil Simon's most famous play might be The Odd Couple. And it's all about two men who are divorced, who live together. You probably maybe saw the TV series back in the day. Two men are divorced and who are living together post being divorced, finding that the fights they have with their wives are the fights they're now having with each other. And a lot of it is about not keeping short accounts, as in this scene.
All right, Oscar, I'd like to know what's happened.
What's happened?
Something made you go off the deep end like that. Now, what is it? Is it something I said or something I did?
Nothing you said. Now, don't stop me, Felix.
Oscar, what is it? Is it the cooking or the cleaning, the crying?
I'll tell you exactly what it is. It's the cooking, the cleaning, the crying. It's the talking in your sleep. It's those moose calls that open your ears at 2 o'clock in the morning. Can't take it anymore, Felix. I'm cracking up. Everything you do irritates me. And when you're not here, the things I know you're going to do when you come in irritate me. You leave me little notes on my pillow. Told you 158 times I cannot stand little notes on my pillow. We are all out of cornflakes, F.U. Took me 3 hours to figure out that F.U. was Felix Unger.
So that was a key thing that Grace and I learned. I would be doing small things that would annoy her. She wouldn't want to feel petty by bringing up such small things. So for instance, you didn't do the dishes when you said you would do it, or, you know, you draped a sweater over a couch and you forgot about it and I had to pick it up and I felt disregarded, or some small thing. Grace would feel petty to bring up such a small thing. She doesn't mind hanging up the sweater. You know, it's no big deal to take a few extra minutes to do dishes on a night. It's no big deal. But here's the rule of thumb. If some small provocation in a relationship has happened, and you don't think it'll ever cross your mind again. It's done. You've forgotten about it. Fine. Feel free not to mention it and just move on. But the moment it comes back to mind and you haven't dropped it, you're advised to keep short accounts to bring it up. And here's why. Because if you don't, so the dishes happens. And let's say the next time the dishes happens, the next night, I do the same thing. And she's like, gosh, that's four nights in a row. This is unbelievable. And she still doesn't bring it up. I can do it. But now she's grinding her teeth a bit. The time it happens again, or now it's not even the dishes thing. Now it's the sweater thing or something. And then she lets me have it, let's say hypothetically. Well, she hasn't kept short accounts. Or if I do it to her, I haven't kept short accounts. The benefit of short accounts is it's usually easy to address small conflicts. So hypothetically, let's say she were to come to me and say, you know, we'd agree we would alternate doing the dishes, but now it's the third day in a row and you didn't do the dishes and I did. And I just, when you didn't do the dishes, I guess I felt a little disregarded. And I could then say something like, oh my gosh, you're totally right. And it was on my screen. It's mine. I had to do the dishes and I was planning to do it. And then I realized I had this work email I had to kind of quick get to. So I quick got up from dinner and I went over to the computer to do my work email and I completely forgot about it. I got kind of immersed because there was other stuff there and I'm so sorry and I'm on it. So in keeping a short account, it's very addressable. It's like, that's not a big conflict. Then she could just say, well, thanks so much. Appreciate it. And you know, I forgive you if I need to. And anyway, thought I'd let you know and we're done. But once it goes to that second day, that third day, that small offense upon small offense upon small offense, then we got a problem because then anger gets engaged and then, you know, all the other sorts of things we talked about can happen. Keep short accounts. Big rule. Here's a best practice when someone raises conflict with you. It's to reflect back to them what you heard them saying. This keeps us from arguing against what's called a straw man. And it seems often remedial because you feel like I'm just using the words they just used. But maybe you can see the power of this. So for instance, let's use our same hypothetical example. I'm not even sure if this is one of the things Race and I thought about, but hypothetically, let's say it was. So let's say she is good at keeping short accounts and I haven't done the dishes when I was supposed to, but it kind of irks her a little bit. She does them, but then she keeps short accounts. So she says, when you didn't do the dishes, I felt disregarded. Let's say I'm testy. And so I reflect back to her and say, so what you're saying is I'm just an inconsiderate slob. Well, that would be a straw man, right? A straw man is an argument the other person is not actually making that you're arguing against. So then it would give her the opportunity to come back to me and say, actually, that's not what I'm saying. I don't even think that. You are not, in general, an inconsiderate slob. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, tonight, when you didn't do the dishes, I felt disregarded. And then I could try again to reflect back what I heard her saying. And sooner or later, what I would say to her is, okay, so what you're saying is, just tonight, not as a whole thing, not as a sweeping statement in our relationship, but for tonight, when I didn't do the dishes, you felt disregarded. Is that correct? And then she could say, that's correct. And then we know we're talking about the same thing. So anyway, a classic best practice when someone raises conflict with you to keep our defensiveness from taking over is to reflect back what you heard them say. Now, there are two famous no-nos in resolving conflicts. Here's the first one. The first one is using the words always or never. You always do this bad thing or you never do this good thing. It's a no-no. It's a no-no for obvious reasons. One, it's not keeping short accounts because if somebody always does some bad behavior or never does some good behavior, and this is the first time this person is bringing it up, they have not kept short accounts. They've been tallying. It's already gone south. Secondly, it's very unlikely that anybody always is bad or never is good. And so it invites the person to say, that's not true. I remember back in January, I did do that thing you say I never do. Or, you know, there's always an exception to the rule. We're getting lost in the weeds here. Again, the rule of thumb. When you did X, a single instance, not a pattern ideally, I felt Y, and then we're good to go. So to common no-no, using the words always or never, never goes well. There we go, never. The second common no-no is character assassination. That's where you label someone rather than say, when you did X, I felt Y. So let's use my dishes example. Grace could have come to me, I'm not saying she said this, and say, you are such an inconsiderate person. You're just so inconsiderate. Well, that's a label as opposed to saying, when you didn't do the dishes, I felt why. Now, the reason character assassination, labeling someone as bad with a descriptor doesn't go well is one, it's probably not accurate. That's probably a very harsh way of looking at a behavior. It reflects we have not kept short accounts, so we're at fault somewhat if we are tempted to start using character assassination. And it also typically in the end is a relationship killer. It's hard to get past. So you know, if you think I am an inconsiderate person, you know, as a character trait, well, why would you want to be in relationship with me if I'm inconsiderate? Who needs that aggravation? And to some degree, why would I want to be in relationship with you if you're judging me so harshly as you seem to be? Character assassination, like using always or never, is a common no-no. I think this could also apply to the story of my friend who's in a relationship with a girlfriend where he has some actual areas of growth that she rightly points out he needs help with. But I think when she gets angry and has held on to them too long, character assassination becomes just irresistible to her, and that can be a tough hurdle to get past. So let me close with a final bit of folk wisdom that I picked up some years later from this early stuff, from a group at the Harvard Business School called the Harvard Negotiation Project. Here's their insight in hard conflicts, often in negotiations. I think it applies to any relationship in a hard conflict. And that's that any hard conflict turns out to be not one, but three conversations. The first conversation, they say, is the what happened conversation. They claim this is where most conversations get derailed. So maybe I'll use a hypothetical conflict. Again, I'm not remembering a specific conflict here, about child rearing. So let's say I were to say to Grace, or Grace were to say to me, I've been doing so much more of the driving kids to their appointments and going to the doctor than you have. And that's not our agreement. You know, we'd agree to do X or Y. And, you know, here's my problem. Now, on the one hand, that could be, you know, a perfect example of something to raise. And when you did X, I felt Y. But let's say it's gone a little bit beyond that and there's some frustration there. Well, it'd be tempting for whoever is being accused of that sin to push back and say, well, that's not technically true. I took, you know, X, Y, or Z kid to a doctor's appointment just last week on Thursday. I took them. It was a two-hour appointment. I was there. And then let's say that's negotiated back. Like, well, yeah, sure, you did that, but I did this, 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 and this. And you say, no, I did more than just that. And so you go end up going back and forth on the facts of the conflict. So they say that's the first level. And usually conflicts, if they're hard conflicts, never get resolved through the what happened conversation. If it's a hard conflict, if it's trivial, it will, because the facts will be agreed upon and you're done. But if it's a hard one, there'll be pushback and just litigating who's correct, who sees things rightly, who understands everything, typically doesn't get the job done, which requires going to the second conversation that's happening kind of subterraneanly in this conversation, which they call the emotions conversation. So maybe the emotions conversation in this one is, I feel disregarded, you know, or I feel unseen, that I, who's either either one could feel that way. The one who feels put upon and has raised the conflict, or the one who's received the conflict, but who's thinking, I do all this stuff for our kids and you don't even see me. So the emotions conversation would involve someone saying, actually, can we just take a break for a second from who did what wrong? I don't know. I guess I'm just feeling sad. It makes me feel like our relationship is in a bad place, that we've had to, you know, I don't know, it's come to this sort of bickering. And, you know, so I'm sorry for my part in the conflict. Let's try to work it out. But maybe I just want to say I feel sad, or I feel unloved or unseen. There's an emotion behind it. You can see, right, how that would be helpful, because there's a vulnerability to getting to the second conversation. It's not just what happened. It's how are people feeling in the midst of the conversation itself. Now, I don't know how this works in big time negotiations with hard conflicts, but the Harvard Business School Negotiation Project people tell us it's still a very important beat to get to if you're getting stuck in the what happens conversation. But then that leads to the third conversation, which is where the gold has been for Grace and me for sure in conflict resolution over the years. They call that the identity conversation. And what they say is that in any really hard conflict, there's the what happens as you try to negotiate whatever the facts are. There's the emotions that are there. But underneath that almost always is a threat to our identity. And so if it's a hard conversation, what it means is we're both kind of fighting like cornered cats to not have to give on this. Why are we fighting like cornered cats? They would say, well, it's because some part of your identity is feeling threatened by this conversation. So on the one I just suggested, maybe the part of the identity that's threatened is, if it's, let's say Grace is raising it with me, is that I feel like, gee, I wonder if she's saying I'm a bad parent, I'm a bad dad, just a bad dad. And that feels so threatening, let's say hypothetically, because I so want to be a good dad. And yet I'm afraid maybe I am a bad dad. I see all sorts of ways in which I've failed my kids, or in, according to my own standards, I could have done better. And so I might be even amenable that I am a bad dad, but that feels so threatening and so hard. And or if she feels like I'm saying she's a bad mom, so threatening. And so if we don't acknowledge, if we don't get to the third conversation, the identity conversation, then we never get to what's really happening, and we can't really give in. We can't really make progress. So let's say hypothetically, and Grace and I have had this happen many times. This is actually fairly common tactics in our own difficult conflicts. We're both familiar with this. It's not uncommon at all in a difficult one that one of us will finally say, oh, can I actually go to the identity conversation for a minute? We'll use this technical language. And then we'll say, sure. So let's say it's me. I say, I guess here's the identity issue that's being poked at with this, is that I'm a bad dad. And that feels so threatening and so scary. Here's what's helpful about that. That's usually where you get the breakthrough. Because then what Grace could say to me, or if she says, I feel like I'm a bad mom, what I could say to her, let's say she could say to me is, oh my goodness, I think you're a terrific dad. I guess it's just I was frustrated right now because it seems like we're in a busy stretch and lots of parenting is needed. And I didn't feel like you're pulling your weight as much as you could or had said you would, but I by no means think you're a bad dad. I think you're a fantastic dad. I think you love your kids. I think you're present. I think you're present to me in my parenting dilemmas. I couldn't be happier with you as a parenting partner. Now, so if that's what you're feeling, let me alleviate that and say that's not at all what I mean to say. Once that moment's happened, the conflicts usually get resolved quickly because then it's just about, okay, if that's not being threatened, how do we work out however we need to go forward and whoever has to say they're sorry and that sort of stuff. It's usually pretty easy at that point. So three conversations, according to the Harvard Negotiation Project people, the what happened conversation, the emotions conversation, and most profoundly, the identity conversation. Very useful to know. So let me review the folk wisdom. Folk wisdom, the central formula in all conflict resolution is this phrase, when you did X, I felt Y, the central formula. The next bit of folk wisdom, keep short accounts. Don't let things pile up. Something small happens. It feels petty to bring it up. If you can drop it emotionally, not even think about it again, fine. But the second you think about it again, you got to bring it up because you don't want it to stack up and then you got a problem. Keep short accounts. A best practice when someone raises conflict with you is to reflect back what you heard them saying until you are both agreeing that that is what they're saying. So that our defensiveness, if someone's raised conflict with us, we're not letting that spill out into fighting an argument that they're not making, into fighting a straw man. Two common no-nos in resolving conflicts. The first is using always or never. The second is character assassination, labeling someone as bad in some way. And then the Harvard Negotiation Project people say there's three conversations happening in any hard conflict. The what happened conversation, the emotions conversation, and most profoundly, the identity conversation. And to review, on the contemplative side, the advice, as always in contemplative practice, is every time you do, multiple times a day if possible, be a contemplative. Go to your inner man or woman, your true self, the alcove behind the waterfall, and just notice whatever is tumbling out. Be aware of it. Welcome it if need be, but don't try to fix it. Just notice it. If there's a hard thing that you can relax and release, by all means do. Let it go. Move forward. And that the thing you're not doing here is having to, in the churn of your emotions and conflicts and things like that, having to constantly ruminate over and churn over who's right, who's wrong, what went wrong, how do you figure this out, etc. It's really just having the ability to observe it, let it go if possible, and trust that God has good plans for you in it. And we're told there's a true self in that that you're going to like. So let me go back again to that, to Merton for a moment. I think he would say it's impossible to experience your true self, who you actually are, the part of you that God is active in empowering, without mastering the things we talked about here. Because when we have unresolved conflicts, we're so stirred up, so frothy, that we can't make our way behind the waterfall to that powerful true self. Now, of course, this is all a lifelong task, no doubt. All of us, if we're growing, are going to learn new things about these sorts of things as we go. And as per my story about my friend who had a friend of hers suddenly cut off contact, this is not to say we can control anyone else's behavior. But that story shows the power of a contemplative approach to conflict resolution, which empowers us to let go what we can't resolve. All the good things God is doing inside you as you grow in the ways we talk about on this podcast, they offer a great opportunity for those things to spill over for good in the relationships you care about. For some of us, sheltering at home with other people is going to be a great growth opportunity along these lines. So God bless you as you put these things to work, whatever your situation. Well, that's it for this Journey On podcast. I will see you soon.